Welcome to A Lovely Wallpaper, a podcast exploring an underappreciated way of appreciating poetry by committing it to memory. To know a poem by heart means having a worry stone, a provocation, a comfort, a quick exit, always close at hand. Lose yourself in a poem, gain a world with its mastery.
The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that a loss is no disaster.
In this episode, we will work with the helpful voice of Nora Lang, author of the novel Us Fools, which won the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction, and author of the forthcoming short story collection, Daycare. She will present a very, very short piece by Lydia Davis, Collaboration with Fly. The funny thing is that my first idea for Nora and for this episode was to make a gesture towards something very, very long. There is this moment midway through Nora's novel, Us Fools, where the narrator, Bernadette, has just broken out from under the shadow of her very eccentric older sister, Joanne. And she talks about carrying around a photocopy of Loomings, the first chapter of Moby Dick. I love that she was, in her moments of adjustment to a new city and desperation in the absence of her sister's always baroque activity, sitting, trying to drive off the spleen with a watery view of Lake Michigan and some iconic gallows humor. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever I get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. The cool thing about the way Nora uses Melville's totemic text, it's that Moby Dick becomes a bit of a key for differentiating these two sisters. Joanne, well, she also loves Moby Dick, and she shows her enthusiasm by staging a sperm whale drawing competition, making for a memorable scene amongst her horny high school classmates, and offering as a prize a copy of Moby Dick with a signature she forged with her father's enthusiastic help. One sister is porous, a writer bathing in Melville's words. The other, a perpetual performance artist. Nora herself is definitely both sisters. Beyond just these direct references, there's a deep affinity for Melville here in Nora's work. There's a slow-moving elusiveness, a penchant for listing. There's an ambitious interest in explicating the systems and the sicknesses that make America. There's a 19th century lack of interest in economy of prose. Although Nora and I did not chop Moby Dick's iconic opening lines into a memory exercise, Nora's ultimate choice, Collaboration with Fly, like the larger work, harnesses a creature to deal in big themes of aesthetics and ownership and violence. Welcome, Nora.
Thank you, Abby, for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you.
I'm excited to chat with you about your work. Let's get back to some of these big books later. What I want to start on today is Underpants. I thought you'd be okay with that. At this piece reading of your novel, Us Fools, last year, you were hawking skivvies. Once it said Balzac, once it said Hilma af Klimt. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how these amazing undergarments related to your text?
Yeah, that's hilarious. This is the second time in a week this has come up, so I'm happy to talk about it. Well, I have a sort of secret life of, you know, just jotting down for me French sort of sexy puns as I see them. So yeah, my notebooks are pretty full, and the Af Klimt was just to sort of, perhaps for some subtly, for others more unambiguously reference, you know, a woman's clit. And then Balzac, on the other hand, you know, haha. So yeah, they're a way for me to just take pleasure in language and have a little fun sort of outside of the rigor of writing that I sometimes find myself in. Yeah, it's just to be cheeky, quite literally, you know. So yeah, those undergarments, they're men's briefs. If for your listeners, it's hard to perhaps picture what the actual garment looks like. So they're just a kind of a classic men's brief.
But this was also something that the sisters in your novel, Us Fools, were creating, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so I think that funneling into things happens in my work, where if I have an interest, if it ends up making sense, if it's logical, incorporating it into the text itself. So, and then my other sort of sneaky thing is that, and I can't remember which came first, I'd have to look back, but I decided to, you know, create a company for these French sort of sexy, cheeky puns. And so in doing that, which is, there's a lot of bureaucratic work and also some cash involved, and the organization's called Dada, I was like, you know, I don't know when this LLC is going to kind of go through these like bureaucratic loopholes. So I was like, well, if it's in a novel and the novel is published, right, and I have these things that I've done in this published novel, I felt like it would help my, if someone were to ever come for me, if my application were ever to like falter, I could at least point to the, like, the, you know, the verified text in the book.
ISBN number behind you.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, you know, that sounds a little paranoid, but, you know, you do what you can, you know, small mountains.
I mean, it's like a kind of a facetious merch drop. I love that in a book that is constantly critiquing capitalism. Give me some context for the sisters creating these.
I feel like they're in Alaska at this time, and I think they're just trying to monetize a little project. And I think that they are entrepreneurial in spirit in different capacities. You know, I think this Etsy account that they are building, this business, if you will. Yeah, they're just trying to make a little cash. It feels to me almost like an adult version of the lemonade stand or something. You know, how do you stand out? Does your lemonade have, like, I don't know, some tequila in it? Versus, I mean, so I think they're just, it kind of, you know, harkens back to their younger days, you know, getting by, into like translating that into like an adulthood entrepreneurial vision, while also being performative. Like, as you mentioned earlier, Joanne's performance, you know, she's drawn to performative behaviors. And she's like, going back to even the sort of Dadaist banquets, right? This whale drawing, sperm whale drawing competition, she both does to like activate and kind of, you know, sort of turn the knife. And so she's got this sort of, yeah, these characteristics in her. And I feel like the book is sort of like a systematic, they're like these expressions of ideas in different ways. And to me, the undergarments are an expression of some of this performance, this entrepreneurial, this sort of like hustle, right? And the artist, right? Kind of, that's just another expression of those sensations, if you will.
So both of the characters are homeschooled, you know, as looking at their Etsy business, you know, in adulthood. And it's interesting because usually that comes from a place of like a very strong religious or philosophical framework. And usually one that's very sheltering, like very kind of protective of kids from the outside world. But these girls, their curriculum, it feels like it's almost all contemporary American politics and scandal and some Ovid. Tell me more about homeschooling.
Well, I have no personal relationship to homeschooling. I think there are two parts, right? I mean, I think that the parents are, you know, not necessarily saddest, like they're a little bit, you know, awkward in their own right. I could just say that. I think that, I mean, Joanne later does go to public school, but, and they both end up in schools. But, you know, at this early point, I think that Sylvia, the mother, is just attempting to imbue them with what she sees the complications of the world being, which is this juxtaposition between a kind of classic mythology and like present day scenarios, which I don't think she thinks is being far off. But in fact, there needs to be a kind of like synthesizing or, you know, overlay and this kind of notion of mapping. And so I think, yeah, I mean, and there are these moments where, you know, Henry the father would check out like the New Yorker magazine from the public library. And so their minds are very active. They're interested people. And I think, yeah, like they both have their quirks themselves. So, but personally, I have no, my parents didn't homeschool me or anything like that. I just think maybe in a sense, we, if you're a curious person, you do it yourself, right? Like, I think that as a kid, I was a very curious person and I just collected the things that interested me and I tried my best to like inform myself. I still to this day am one of these people who have like thousands of notes in my, you know, a book. I look up words, you know, I in fact like circled one yesterday. Like I don't shy away from that. It's a pleasure for me. So I think, you know, if we're looking for connections between my thought process and like what happens in these books, there's both just the sort of practical that I didn't experience homeschooling, but I do experience curiosity.
I mean, it's a great way into making this family very purely itself from the start, you know,
yeah.
Purely a product of these kind of disparate personalities and their ways of reconciling high culture, low culture, the input of the news, the rabbit holes of the library. It's very cool. I mentioned Ovid a second ago. Ovid comes up in your work all the time. It's not just in Us Fools, in Joanne and Bernadette's education. The stories of Ovid come up in like maybe a third of your stories in Daycare. Just, you know, quick passing references. But tell me a little bit about your connection to Ovid.
Yeah. I mean, Ted Hughes is the general translator that I go to for Ovid. And I think, I mean, well, there are two parts, right? So the immediate thing that comes to mind is I spent, you know, my like at least 11 years in the academy, like teaching college students, university students. And I often went back to Ovid to teach. So I know it sort of inside and out, but I'm also, I never tire of my interest in pieces and these warnings or these metamorphoses. Yeah. And I think that it feels like a really good, like I was going to say the word baseline, but that makes it sound like we're going to the doctor, which is kind of like, I mean, it's poetry. It's just, I can go back to it time and time again. It doesn't get old in the way that fiction ages differently than poetry, I think. And so maybe there's something about that. But yeah, the quick, most direct thing is I, you know, was a professor. That was my life. And I think that poetry is just something, I think there's something intuitive and innate about it in a different way than fiction.
Right. I mean, I love that you said warnings before metamorphosis when you're kind of talking about what's at the root of Ovid. I mean, it's, you always think about changes, about characters changing. But yeah, I mean, there are also, there's this element that you forget about that's, you know, the moral warning. In your prose, you're always dodging expectations. That's like a very, very big way of approaching writing for you, I feel like. You know, you're setting up for one thing and then something utterly different happens, you know, even on the micro level of sentence by sentence. You know, you dodge expectations in this way that evokes metamorphosis. Also, can feel violent almost as well. So I was reading, around the time I was reading Us Fools, I also was reading Henry James's What Maisie Knew. I found myself having the same reaction over and over again to both books, which was like, wait, how old is she? And I mean, in the case of Maisie, it's because the adults are unloading crazy things on her. And you keep on thinking like, how old is she? Why are they telling her this? Or like, what are they doing to her? I mean, maybe she's one of the terms you use for Joanne and Bernadette often is junk kid. Maisie is a bit of an original junk kid in American literature in some ways. I think the case could be made. But in the case of your sisters, it's both what the adults are kind of unloading on them and exposing them to, and the things that they say themselves. They are, I mean, like we kind of talked about a second ago with this innate curiosity that the homeschooling kind of device lets you put at the forefront. Both of them are incredibly precocious. Like, what would you say to readers who say that these kids are unnaturally and unrealistically precocious?
That you haven't met kids like them yet is what I would say. But they're there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think that, and now I can't remember which book it was exactly, but when we made them, I think a year or so older, and I did write the publisher, and because I went back and I don't remember if it was Beverly Cleary or it was Judy Blume, but I was like, you know, I went back to some of these books and the ages were actually very similar to the characters in Us Fools, such that, you know, some of the ideas that they were, you know, menstruation or whatever, like just talking about it or whatever was happening wasn't far off. And I don't know if our minds, like, you know, since those books, the Judy Blume, if we just, I don't know, but maybe our tolerance is different. Maybe things just seem more radical. I mean, I do think that the sisters in Us Fools are precocious, but I also feel like if everyone shared their secrets of like their inner lives with people, it might come across as its own thorny mess. And I don't know, maybe, so it could be a combination of things. Maybe you haven't met these kids yet. Maybe you don't know their inner lives, maybe, which is probably true, even if you could meet kids and not know their inner lives. Or we've somehow, you know, distanced ourselves from some of these inner workings, or things have become tamer. And I will say that I can use my own personal self as an example, that like I can go back to my youth and particular ages and know what I was thinking and saying. And so I can, you know, use myself as an example that the apple didn't fall far from the tree in the case of these characters.
Right, right. I mean, I think the thorniness of the interior life is a great thing to evoke. I mean, one of the things that's really cool about your style is that I feel like you kill a lot of sacred cows of like the writing orthodoxies of now, where things need to feel very realistic all the time. And uncanniness in people's behavior is not really welcome, or inexplicable, unmotivated behaviors. Mm. I guess when I said precocious before, I was thinking about some of the blaseness of the girls talking about what's wrong with American culture in a way that they are kind of a combination of parroting their parents and of totally original thought and performance, like cool. I'm thinking about, there's a moment that keeps on coming back throughout the story where Joanne throws herself off the roof of her house.
Mm-hmm.
And she's pretty blasé about it. You know, it's not a melodramatic, it's never staged as like a suicide attempt that we need to dig into. It's not treated with the solemnity. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I feel like that feels like a moment in which I went through the motions of suicide with this character. And so I explored it. But in the end, I didn't feel like that was something I needed to clarify for her. I feel like the act of falling that distance and deciding to do it, it's very clear that her intention was to hurt herself. I don't need to spell that out much more. But I also think the added component is she really did want to know what it would feel like. And I think that those two things just live side by side, like so many things live side by side, like thinking about someone's Instagram feed where they're saying, you know, stop this war. And then there's a picture of like them giving, you know, I don't know what, like eating oatmeal. I don't know. You know, it's like these juxtapositions are not unnatural and they're not new. And I think, you know, another word for it could be like, I mean, the Instagram feed is one such version, right? But then another such version that's perhaps subtler, not in the case of Joanne in terms of jumping off the roof, but just could be the word nuance, you know? And I think that she has a dark swirl for sure. And I mean, even thinking about her makes me sad, but also happy because she's full of delight. But I think that she wanted to know what it would feel like, but she also, you know, Yeah. And I think as a writer, I didn't really want to. It wasn't a story about Joanne and like that deep. Like, I mean, it is a story about Joanne, but I wasn't focused on, you know, what is it to have violent parents? Like they're all just kind of being, you know, and these themes are there and they're explored, but they're not explored in a kind of clinical sense, or at least not the kind of classical clinical sense. Plenty of people explore these themes in a non-clinical sense. Like, I feel like Rachel Aviv does an excellent job, even though she was in a clinic. So there is that too. But anyway, I think I'm just saying that these characters were explorations of certain ideas, but without, for me, even though I went through them writing-wise, I just decided to eliminate because I didn't want them to be bogged down in a certain way. I wanted something else to surface, which was this idea that things can be paired and things can be juxtaposed and things can be nuanced.
And yeah, bogged down, they don't get. There's a humorous kind of light touch comes from these moments of absurdity and darkness together, for sure. I actually, towards the beginning of the book, I kept on thinking of, do you know Robert Altman's Popeye?
No, I don't.
Oh my God, Nora.
That sounds so good.
Watch this movie.
Writing it down.
Robin Williams is Popeye. Shelley Duvall is Oliver.
Oh, I must have seen this. I mean, this is from like the 80s, right?
Yeah. I can't remember what year. Yeah, probably 80s. And it's so good. Sylvia could watch it too.
That sounds great.
It's got great music in it. It's got great weird music in it. But, you know, it's Altman style where everybody's talking over each other all the time. You know, you have multiple conversations happening at once in this kind of chaotic way. But then because this is also Popeye, the conversations are totally absurd and they are funny and violent at the same time. And they have, you know, food fights and romance at the same time. And, you know, whatever. Anyways, so much of the opening of your book kind of made me think of that type of staging because you had these four characters, at least if we're taking only the family into account and we're bringing in other school friends, et cetera, as time goes on. But everybody is on their own weird trip and reacting to each other and following their own threads all at once. And a lot of things that seem superficially just like absolutely slapstick.
Mm-hmm.
This dark core that doesn't always come out, but then kind of pings off of the other characters. The other characters kind of like absurd expressions.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was great for the first, you know, the first probably 80 or 100 pages I was reading, it really felt very much that way. But in repetition, it was funny how much it knit together to become a more kind of classic family unit in this way. I'm sorry I don't have a question to ask you.
Oh, that's fine. I love hearing this. This is wonderful. I mean, Shelley Duvall, gosh.
Oh, she is so good in that role. I mean, close your eyes and think about Shelley Duvall as Olive Oil. You know, she was put on this earth to do that role.
100%.
So your new short story collection, Daycare, is out this month. In Throwback, your character goes to an alt-wedding expo. In a dream that's guided by a friend that is existing both in the past and in the future. Do you think you could read a passage of that for me starting on page 51?
Naomi says it's time to go. We park and walk over to the sign-in table where overjoyed greeters hand us our free tote bag. It's going to be fun. It's a tote bag. I'm terrified. Too much expression is being expressed. Why am I here? I ask the spirit. Because, she says, you pitched Jezebel on a fear and loathing at the bridal expo piece. Don't worry, she explains. Your editor will leave, and the incoming editor won't respond to any of your follow-up emails. I stuff the tote into my backpack. Within the expo's rented space, there is another space called the unique space, which in 1996 we would have called meta. Naomi slaps me and tells me to pay attention. This alternative wedding expo has photographers, caterers, event planners, and dressmakers, even slow motion video skee-ball, one of the first redemption games, photo booths, a cocktail bar, anything unique. Despite Naomi's objections, I go to the bar. The bartender, a Jamie Dornan type, Says his company infuses their vodkas. Yeah, the Dornan type adds at the end of his sentence, landing like a rapper, hopeless and in earnest, like he is about to unlock the red room of pain. I send Naomi a text. Does he know what he sounds like? She takes my phone away. Despite all the unwise decisions I've made, I found myself stuck between B-Ride, D and Groom, a mix of green apple-infused rye, butterscotch, tincture, key lime juice, lime, and Sour Patch candy. Or Rose Lips, a rose-infused vodka, muddled blackberries, splash of Prosecco, lemon juice, and a white rose petal garnish. And the Till Death Shots, vials filled with blood orange vodka, sold as the answer to the traditional ceremonial champagne toast. Tincture guy clarifies, and guaranteed to take your wedding to a higher level by not just light your guests on fire or blow your grandparents out of a festively decorated cannon. I turned to Naomi to tell her all that had come of her timeline experiment was that now I wanted to uproot, overdose in the ocean, and call it a night. She calls me a dark fiancé, even darker as a white, hands me cold water, and guides me over to a booth of alternative wedding event designers. The most popular event themes, the woman working at the booth volunteers, were anything Star Wars, retro comic book, and Jim Henson. In her lookbook are blushing brides in a creamy lace long gowns, beautifully manicured hands rubbing R2-D2, which could set you back $10,000. All that money made me ravenous. Luckily, the spirit was hungry too. Though, where did Naomi put it? I ask her. She licks my face. Outside, it is easy to find food. There is only one truck. Food, perhaps, being the most important part of a wedding celebration, and here was just one vendor selling kale. This event sucked. Kale is fine, but not on weekends. Saturdays are for pizza, bagels, hot dogs. Naomi pulls out a pocket knife and threatens to cut out my tongue, Ovid style. Jesus, she's from Ontario. The spirit asks why it's so tough for me to see the origin of my unhappiness. She then points out that one third of the booths are photo-related. Alternative weddings are also tethered to the traditional wedding photographer.
Thank you, Nora.
My pleasure.
Passage is so funny and so full of funny lines. But I want to talk about subversion here, right? This is an alt wedding expo. Why did you choose this as the site for this story where our dark fiance, darker wife ends up? Your ghost friend, of course.
Yes, because I went to it. And also, I think I was disappointed probably at how not alternative it was, you know? And I think that, you know, if this idea of like co-option, like that's often what, you know, capitalism does, it co-opts these things that perhaps for one time were meaningful, you know, and turns them into these like sort of to these parodies, really. But people buy into it quite literally. I think I was just kind of like, this sucks. Like, I'm so bummed, you know? And it was passed.
Becomes part of a story of a character who really is reflecting and putting some thought into how to approach an institution like marriage in a way. It's like, I mean, the character holds this type of commodified subversion at arm's length, but also wants to figure out how to legitimately subvert the institution of marriage before entering it.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I can remember her innards and her outards to form, or pleasingly anyways, so that she doesn't come out of the book and murder me, I feel like there's a sense when you're engaged that, you know, you do get married, right? So I think that once presented with that reality, that's the kind of full stop. And I do think, I don't even know that she wants, I mean, I don't know, but I feel like you could subvert the format of marriage, but it's more even just, here's this thing that plugs itself as a kind of alternate option, and yet it doesn't really come through. And I think it would be a great follow-up story to know what the character envisions, you know, her dream marriage to be. But I think for the sake of the story, it was just sort of exploring what this alternative thing sold itself as being. And that in the end, it really was just kind of generic, really. Or predictable, let's say, you know.
As predictable as your work gets.
Yeah, maybe. But I did actually go to one and had intended to write about it. So it was kind of, I mean, you know, some of these pieces in this collection, to use the popular parlance, is like, they're like auto-fictive, right? So there is a bit of, you know, some nonfiction in there sprinkled alongside these other bits, like Naomi's spirit, no such thing. But yeah, having actually gone myself to this expo, there is that. And Abby, you know, my husband's name is Nick, and he's often used as Nick or referenced as Nick, this husband character who shows up in this collection. So yeah, I think, you know, writing is, it's so many things, and I'm in no position to single anything out. But I think that, you know, if it's a mode of expression at one sort of simple level, it can be nice to use these names that are familiar and as a way to get to some kind of core. So, yeah.
I mean, as Naomi's spirit guide says, at some other point in the story, not in the passage you read, she says, "I've been reading your mind." I guess it's like beginning of the dream. You've been sick trying to figure out what happened to Irony. And it does feel like the main character is going on a mission, trying to figure out how earnest this all is.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it does have a little bit of like The Wizard of Oz or something. It has a kind of, you know, the tonality of this story, you know, even though I'm borrowing the structure of whatever Scrooge, what is that? I don't even like the Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
I'm borrowing the structure of Christmas Carol. You know, it has a bit of like, you know, the Yellow Brick Road component too, in terms of like, you know, yeah, just exploring what this future holds in terms of a marriage.
Yeah, the journey has wonders that are hard to fully trust.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just funny. I mean, I think too, like, at the end of the day, the piece for me is about like just humor. And I feel like I'm constantly trying to remind myself of the things that, like the pleasure in humor. I think humor is one of the most pleasurable parts of existing or reading or anything, you know? And I think, so while there's this thread of like, what is marriage? I mean, there are probably other stories that dive into that in a different way. I think this one is just kind of like, you know, a little bit more, leans more heavily into like just straight up humor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess the question going to something like this is not so much what is marriage, but what is a wedding? And if you
do
something that's purely a symbolic act, like what types of symbols can you heap on top of it? Are to use and theme cocktails and photo booths and skee ball games and what?
Totally.
It's a blank slate.
And it's also, though, like weddings are this thing that the memory of it becomes almost, though, you know, it's sort of like the picture version of your marriage, right? Like, what did someone say? It was my mother-in-law. So my brother-in-law just got married almost a year ago. We're approaching a year. And he had two weddings and we only went to one, you know, asterisk, small child, and one was all we could do. And at the wedding that we didn't go to, apparently my mother-in-law stood up and said, everyone here at this wedding, you know, is like forever in this like marriage. We're all like kind of part of this union, this marriage from here until, I mean, I guess death, right? But like, that's like the promise. Anyway, and I just thought, well, that's so intense. But people view this moment, or these, you know, succession of moments in a wedding as this kind of like, you're like, the people there are witness, right? Like witness to this matrimony. And so they're like these little ghosts, like all, you know, these little mites in your bed forever. I mean, I'm teasing, but I guess I'm just saying that, you know, while it is this, while we think of it as this snapshot, but the snapshot becomes the strange, perhaps metaphor for the rest of this couple's time together. And I think that's fascinating. So is it banal? You know, whatever happens, like if you're getting like super, you know, like spooky about it, is what happens at your wedding banal? Or are these things like strange indicators? You know, like, is it like that these people are with you for the rest of your time as a union, you know, as my mother-in-law proclaimed, you know, in front of this amassed group of people, which I think if I had been there, if my mouth had been full, I may have come out, you know, but I was like drinking or whatever, because I think I would have been like, oh my God, talk about Ovid.
Oh my gosh. You'd have transformed into a creature all of a sudden. Okay, well, now speaking of this like foreverness and till death do us part and everything, a kind of different tone, I'd love to look at a passage from your story, Fork, as well.
Sure. Yeah, my pleasure.
Could you start on page 109 at I saw the pictures? And just to contextualize it a little bit, the narrator of the story has traveled to Providence for the funeral of a friend she's been out of touch with, right? And she hasn't been invited.
I saw the pictures. He died surrounded by family and friends, some of them hours that we made together and some I'll never know. There was a photograph with his new wife. I liked her. I could tell from the photo. I too would have preferred to say goodbye in person, to explicitly tell him I loved him. I never wrote out the words as precisely. Maybe I wrote them exactly. But I love you by itself rings deficient. Then again, nothing can be known for certain because all communication between us had been done over email, and email was without intonation. I knew I'd written, can I do anything? How can I help you? I am thinking of you. I am sending good thoughts. What a waste of words, though. I meant every one of them. I arrived early to the cemetery. I was alone except for a young boy and his mother laying out roses on a patch of perfectly articulated grass. They were clasping hands loosely. And as he would have wanted, I took out my book and picked up where I left off. The clouds moved. The sky darkened. A few pages in, I crawled inside of my gut and out through my eyes, but these were not possible. I felt lightheaded. I pulled up my orange sweater to peek at the red fork drawing. It was there. I began to howl and laugh ferociously. I grieved myself into an imperfect circle on the damp grass. The boy and his mother were briskly heading in my direction. Clutching the book in one hand and his baby fork in the other, I rolled onto my back and looked at the sky. I thought about Band-Aids tucked safely in my backpack. The boy and his mother were close. I could smell them. They smelled sweet and kind and like a good omen. I wished to tell them mother and child about my own childhood, to share with them a bit about this goldfish named Pepper that in the end had lived a very long life. Initially, my mother warned me that Pepper would not last through the night. The fish was used to being on display and traveling throughout America, seeing the sights. I told her that I would keep the fish in fresh water. I would love the fish. That's all it would take for it to prosper. I would put Pepper in a sturdy glass bowl with clean water and talk to it lovingly, which calmed my mother and probably saved the fish's life. That goldfish had outlived my mother's expectations. She had said Pepper would last a year, three tops. He had lived for 42 years, just shy of Tish, the oldest goldfish, who held the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest living goldfish in the world. I had won my nearly legendary, almost champ fish at a state fair by clownishly throwing a dart at the ceiling, which in turn popped every target balloon on its way down to the ground. Kids with darts, fish, books. These things should not be underestimated. At the fair, those waiting in line to get their shot at winning applauded. It was unbelievable, they said, clapping on their tippy toes to catch a view of the fish in its little baggie. This went on for a solid 5 minutes before they moved on to something else.
Thank you, Nora.
Thank you, Abby.
I love this. Why do you think the character needs to tell this mother and son at the cemetery about the goldfish? I love that this story pivots to the scene at the fair and the goldfish Pepper. Why? Why does her mind go there?
I think she's thinking about what she'd said previously, like even in that passage, just like the expression, like how we express our love, right? So this, she's lost this dear friend. And she notes in that passage that you had me read that she had written, you know, all these sort of what seemed like futile sentences about love, offering to help, so on and so forth. But, you know, perhaps like the purest form in her now memory of how this expression was translated perhaps more effectively was in this fish that wasn't supposed to live and did. And so maybe it's an example of the potential that she has to offer love and for it to actually work, so to speak, in the way this other version with this human, this friend, maybe something didn't in the way that she would have wished it had. But it was too late, you know? He was dead. So kind of dark, I guess. But I, you know, if we focus on the love part of it, less so.
Yeah.
I also just, I mean, the reversal is so beautiful of the fish being the one who's able to pay attention and people can only pay attention for 5 minutes. I mean, the fish is used to seeing the sights. The fish is this like force that that sees the world around it, whereas the people at the carnival are, you know, dispersing and they have the attention of a goldfish. Yeah, it's just a beautiful reframing of a lot of things.
Were you also, like, familiar, right? Like, we kind of all know that fish in the little baggie, which, like, when I think of little baggie, I think of, like, you know, people with their cocaine, too, or like, you know, a little bag. It just has this, I don't know, there's something that is universal. Not, maybe it's not universal, but I'm a very American.
Audrey Prize is, like, a being that sees and breaks records.
Totally, yeah.
Nora, were you still in the neighborhood when there were all those signs for the missing turtle whose name was Pebicorn?
I don't think so. No.
They lost a turtle, and I love the name more than any other pet name I've ever heard. It was named Pebicorn.
I love that.
P-E-B-A-C-O-R-N, Pebicorn.
What happened? Do you know?
I have no idea, but
no follow-up?
I do know that that name has gone down in my personal history. Great pet name of all time.
It's so good.
Send out our wishes that Pebicorn is somewhere.
Been found years ago. And we know the turtle's age, so.
Yeah.
Pebicorn is doing very well.
A lot of longevity. But yeah, I just love this story. By any chance, did you watch Secret Mall Apartment?
Mm-mm.
Nora.
I know, it's been listening so long. I have Popeye, Robert Altman's Popeye. I have cough drops, zinc, and echinacea. I have
Secret Mall Apartment. It is, you know, the Netflix tendency to just make a documentary of every single thing.
Yes.
The documentary of everything. This was some Providence art kids.
Oh.
You know, kind of like noise music, like lightning bolt type of scene. They found a kind of like a hole where they could enter secretly the Providence Mall, the big mall downtown.
Yeah. Totally.
And they found this like kind of negative space within the walls of the mall and made a little apartment there.
They love that.
Cinder blocks, bricked it up, put in a locking door. And I can't remember how many years they were kind of like entering and exiting the mall and hanging out in their little windowless mall cavity space. I thought it was fantastic.
I love it. You remember when it was made? Just like roughly?
Super recently. I feel like it just came.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool.
You know, direct to Netflix specialty documentary.
Yeah.
You know, not aimed at a general audience.
I love it.
A weirdo audience.
Do you know, like, so the documentary was made recently. Do you know if the occupation of the mall space was a long time ago? Because there was a big kind of like, you know, punk scene, if you will, in Providence, and like squatter scene and art scene.
early 2000s, I believe. Yeah.
Okay. So it was around that time then of that like explosion down. Okay, got it.
You'll recognize some friendly faces.
Yeah, I know. I wonder, actually. That's cool. Awesome.
I never lived there, but it, you know, there was a time when I followed their noise music scene pretty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, I think of that because the mall factors into your story.
Yes.
At this point, you know, we're getting towards the main event, the memory event. Actually, not the main event. The interview's the main event. But I would love to ask you a little bit about what texts you know by heart, since my editor here is always to present something to learn by heart. What's your relationship with, like, learning poetry? Do you have anything that you carry around with you?
I do have this piece. You know, and it's by heart because I taught it for so long too. And I do the insider bit about me, Abby, your friend, Nora, is that I have a lot of, like, I don't like to misquote things. And so I don't have the great privilege of that kind of confidence where I have plenty of friends who are like, I know things by heart. And then sometimes they're actually wrong, which is totally fine. But like, I think that's part of like knowing things by heart, you know, is it's your heart. So I don't know. Anyways, the point is like, I get nervous about the idea that I would declare that I know something. For some reason, it makes me want to run towards references. But I can say, because I taught this very short, two things actually, I taught together, and I can share both of them happily, because I was teaching about the super hyper mini short story and whether or not to students, they would think that either of these things qualified as stories. So I did memorize them, not actively to like set out to memorize them, but just because I'd written them down for so long on the board for students. So the first one is Lydia Davis's collaboration with Fly. I put that word on the page, but he added the apostrophe, is that one. The second one, which we didn't mentioned before, is the Hemingway, and I'm afraid I'm going to botch it, but it's, as far as I remember, for sale, baby shoes never worn.
Yeah, that one's a classic.
Yes, but those were always fun to discuss with students, like, at first glance, right? There doesn't seem to be much there, but actually when you begin to dive in and like, I guess like sort of uncover or explore what the narrative could be, a lot emerges, at least in my classrooms. There were things that people had to say, which was fun. But yeah, so my relationship to memorizing poetry, there probably is stuff in there, but nothing I would ever be confident to share as though I'd memorized it perfectly, because that's just not me.
What's in the chest? It's, you know, it's all pure curiosity. You know, it's funny. When I launched this podcast, you wrote like a very Nora email in response, like breathless enthusiasm, so supportive. I loved it. And then you also said something like, I know all of Sylvia's books by heart.
Oh, that's true.
I had been in the middle of trying to get a biographer, the Red Comet author.
Oh, awesome.
It didn't happen. But I thought that you meant Sylvia Plath's book. So for a moment, I forgot Nora's daughter's name, Sylvia. And then I realized that, yeah, of course, the storybooks, the picture books. I know so many of these things of my kids by heart as well. But it was so funny because I think I went for like, it wasn't immediate. Like for a couple of hours, I was like, wow, that's a lot of.
That's like really impressive.
Randomly in the Paris Review the other day, I saw a poll quote from a Daryl Pinkney interview, Art of Nonfiction. And he says he knows all of Ariel by heart.
That's amazing.
Actively seeking him as he does right now too.
But is it like, this is the thing about the by heart. Is it like, so if someone were to test you on it, I mean, everyone's different, but I would feel totally like, I don't know.
No, I would feel taken too. You know, the whole impulse to explore this knowing things by heart for me is like, I don't want to perform anything. Like there are a bunch of things that I know by heart, but I have no desire to like perform them for anybody. But I like to be able to just have lines, you know,
it's really important.
Like perfectly correctly, but I love to have things, you know, kind of to have that different feeling of something that you're not reading from the page, but that's floating kind of.
No, that's a really beautiful way of viewing it. And I think I have so much of that with like song lyrics, which is pretty like, yeah. I guess, predictable. You know what I mean? But yeah. And also, to be fair, like my dad's a poet. And I think that there was so much sometimes that I think I tend to feel like, you know, just like any kid, you kind of run in different directions. I do think that I'm really returning very heavily. In fact, I've been like writing poems, and it's just interesting to like run towards poetry as like the place that's most comfortable. But sometimes we have to like move away. And I do wish I had an entire novel memorized. That's not, no. That storybook. Storybooks from Sylvia, mostly memorized. Though again, I would be remiss not to point out that I probably...
Do you have any that you're happy to have? You know, with my kids' books, sometimes things that you don't particularly like stick. But some things that are true delight stick too. And you know all the words. Do you have a favorite book of Sylvia's?
Do I have a favorite book? You know what? I love these Chiri-Chara Japanese...
Oh, I love those too.
Books, yeah, they're my favorite. All of them. We tend to like make some of, like, they eat and drink strange coffees and like do sweet things. I mean, they ride bicycles. Chiri-Chara ride bicycles around different Japanese landscapes, and there are different stories being told, often kind of seasonally based, they feel like, winter, spring. And they, you know, sometimes they have interesting little pastries or drinks, and often I try to like replicate some of those drinks and stuff for Sylvia, like a blue moon drink or something. So, yeah, because it's just so imaginative. And yet it's probably just like the like life in Japan. For me, it's imaginative to have these sweets stuffed with these like really interesting flavors. But that I don't know that if I had lived in Japan, that would be imaginative. It might just be what someone eats, you know?
Right, right. I'm sure there's a level of fantasy. I mean, they're eating the sweets with like forest creatures. So, you know, there's...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But it almost goes back to like your original question of like, how do we pair these things that are known and then also these things that are imaginative, right? Like, are the characters, Joanne and Bernadette, people you know a lot of, or are they, do they exist? These kinds of things, right? Yeah, we just don't know the ins and outs of every world.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So yeah, I'm really glad that you picked collaboration with Fly. I knew the Hemingway story. I had heard that before, but I had never heard this one. You know, it's funny. This is kind of a random question, but I've been curious about it. You have a huge affinity for Lydia Davis and Julia Williams as well. But it's funny, those are both, they're both so famous for like ultra brevity.
Mm-hmm.
You don't play that game, right?
I mean...
in some ways, but I mean, what is your
time?
Like, I can see a lot of lines between like you and Davis and you and Williams, but I think superficially people wouldn't necessarily go right there. What are the core things that you feel like binds you to those two writers?
Like, I do feel like maybe I don't have brevity sometimes, but I do think sometimes, though, in looking at stuff, I'm like, I need to edit that. I think there's a precision, but I think that it's misleading because it doesn't feel precise. It may not read at first glance precisely, but I think that there's an enormous amount of precision that's at play. So yeah, I would say that. And I think in that precision, it's a sense of humor too, that I think is important, that's present. So yeah, I would say precision and humor. But again, the humor is just another added word to the word precision. I think it'd be precision on any level. Like precision, any tunnel of precision you want to take, even if it seems flippant, even if it seems sloppy, even if it seems lazy, I don't think so. But yeah, I feel like I learned a lot from them about how to, you know, I think writing is really, for me, I think it's both feels very instinctive, but it's also really, really, really hard. And I think that if you're trying to get at something, it's really, really hard. And I think I looked to those writers as examples of how to get at something and get at it precisely, but also seamlessly in other ways. You know, that precision isn't, getting back to this idea of being bogged down. It's not bogged down. It's its own lightness.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. There's one thing, I guess, reading us fools more than the stories, but maybe in the stories too. Actually, I think in the stories too. Remember how I mentioned before that you kill some sacred cows of like writing?
I loved it. I wrote it down. Yeah.
There are a lot of moments where you say things like, she was raised to believe X, or she had thoughts about X. And those moments are so jarring and so shocking because people, I feel like people don't do that. That's the thing that like would get scribbled out in a workshop or something. I didn't go to an MFA, but this is what I imagine happens there. Like you have to show, I mean, from high school, you have to show, not tell. This is like a big thing. But seeing this type of like just getting straight to the heart of, you know, making this kind of thing that I feel like could be called a generalization, but is actually incredibly precise. It's like, why shouldn't the narrator be able to give a statement about what a character's core values are? You know, it's like, I feel like that's almost become kind of a taboo, but coming back to that is incredibly, it's jarring. It kind of, and it's precise in this way that, you know, we've kind of overlooked in a lot of modern fiction. I mean, I'm making a crazy generalization here, but these moments, it was like, she was raised to believe X. She had thoughts about X. You know, it was that. And, you know, those things. Yeah, I like that you boil it down to precision because there is, you're taking a different route to it from most, which I think is really cool.
And I think for me, it's like a question of balance, right? So if we think about, you know, Bork and like the goldfish scene, if you will, you know, if it were all that, these things lose some kind of gravity or lose their place in a gravitational system such that other things need to be used sometimes to make a kind of balance, to balance things out. Other devices, if you will, whether it's like something super straightforward or not. And I also like the writer Rachel Cusk a lot. And I think that she doesn't shy away from certain like explicitness, like I remember. Neither does Elena Ferrante, like a ton. But, you know, I think these things, yeah, I don't know. Like it's good to have some footing for readers in the midst of other things that you're trying to accomplish, I guess.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I really love this Lydia Davis story. I think it's amazing how much is packed into it. But I feel like one way that I want to get into it before I ask you to go ahead and read, and, you know, we ask our readers to just absorb it, know it by heart, is why is the apostrophe what the fly contributes?
I mean, I guess because it's a collaboration.
Yeah.
I don't know. And maybe it's like being, just adding, you know, I guess you could say, I don't know. I mean, well, I don't know why it's an apostrophe other than
an
just adding components, you know?
Elides two things. It can elide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I also love that it's...
Where is it? Like, I guess, you know?
You know, it's like, it's the least inert of punctuations, I guess. I mean, in all the different roles it can serve. I mean, it's cool because the apostrophe, there's a collaboration and that it elides, but also... there's the ownership element of
the ownership. Yeah, 100%. And which I think feels very authorial, right? So it's like the almost like the opposite. But
take it also and flattened him into art.
Yeah, exactly. And I think too, I mean,
collaboration.
Yeah. And then added the apostrophe, like I don't even know where it is. So it's sort of like a strange little, I mean, I remember one student thinking that like maybe the fly was like landed on the page such that, you know, if you're looking at this printout of these words and the fly is there, it becomes like the apostrophe and it's the writer like acknowledging the fly's shape on the page looking like such, you know, I don't know, but yeah, it does to me too. Like literally an apostrophe is like the ownership of whatever the word is that comes next, right? So Sarah's house, the house belongs to Sarah. So yeah. It's kind of a, like a little bit of a thwarting, perhaps, if it is literal.
Yeah, it gives the fly many roles in the art, you know.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I also think it's interesting that the title itself is like almost as many words as like the piece, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's just, right? Like, it's so many words are in the title. Like, the title gives you, obviously, it's half the meaning of the thing in its entirety. Like, it's called Collaboration with Fly. And also, that was interesting to students, or remembering thinking about it, that it's not the fly, it's not a fly, it's fly. So it's a very, like, sort of, you know, shorthand, or is it something named that, or, right?
Right. Anyways, it's beautiful to be able to reflect on something so short. It's visual, it's visceral, it's violent.
That's so funny. Yeah.
Moby Dick, Collaboration with Whale.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Yes.
How do you flatten the real life into art? I mean, that's a huge question asked so briefly. Nora, would you read Collaboration with Fly for me, please?
I put the word on the page, but he added the apostrophe.
So this is a tiny piece. If you don't already know it by now, we'll give it the lovely wallpaper treatment. Let's repeat it 3 times with the bell, the pause, all that.
I put the word on the page, but he added the apostrophe. I put the word on the page, but he added the apostrophe. I put the word on the page, but he added the apostrophe.
And that was our poem. I hope it unfolded for you in a way which made you glad to make it your own. And I hope you can hold on to it. Review it on paper, or let it live more like a song in your memory. Thank you to Susie Boyt for lending me this podcast's title, to G.W. Sock and the X for use of their song, The Art of Losing, which borrows the words of Elizabeth Bishop. And thank you to my sound engineer, Alex.
Isn't hard.